And this is America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com, on the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course on the beloved NSN app. A couple of Sundays ago, some 700 people gathered in Efrat in the Gush Etzion section of Israel to commemorate the lives of Lucy D. and her daughters Maya and Rina, who were murdered by terrorists 1 year ago. I am sure the majority, if not this entire audience, recalls that on April the 7th of last year, during Pesach, Lucy D. and her daughters were ambushed as they traveled on Route 57 to Tveria. Maya and Rina were killed. Lucy was critically wounded and died 2 days later. And their story, of course, and the story of Rabbi Leo D. and his surviving daughters has certainly been well known throughout the entire Jewish world for the last year. They've commemorated the yard site now before the month of Nisan, as I just described. The actual yard site is coming up during the holiday, and Rabbi Leo D. is with us live via telephone from Israel. Rabbi D., a pleasure to welcome you to JM in the AM.
Yeah, thank you, Nachum, for inviting me.
It's a year later, and those of us who've been through what some would regard as traditional periods of mourning, yours, of course, with the extreme circumstances is very different. But those of us who've been through a mourning period often look at the first year as a benchmark of increased comfort. You get past that first year or close to it, and things seem somewhat different. Is it like that for you and your daughters at this point as you approach the 1 year since this terrible episode?
I think you never forget, and they're with us every minute of every day, but we have a bit more strength now, strangely, just coming to this year, such that people kindly brought us beautiful gifts and messages during the Shiva. They've been sitting in my lounge on a table for the last year, piled up, and literally this week and today I was going through them with my daughter. And we had the strength to read some of them, and we felt we could handle it. So things apparently have changed.
Interesting. So you've had that, what sounds like sort of, in a daze type of experience for the last many months, understandably so. Yet it's amazing how much you've been able to accomplish, if that's the right word. The way that you've spoken publicly and so eloquently about the entire episode and given so many important messages to both the Jewish and the secular world out there, literally around the world. And in addition to that, the initiatives that have been created that you and your daughters have cooperated with to memorialize your three loved ones. So it's interesting that you avoided for all this time, as you just described, picking up some of those mementos and gifts. And at the same time, to us, it seems that you've been the symbol of tremendous strength over the last year.
It's strange, that the reality is that Am Yisrael has given us the strength, and anything that we've been able to do for Am Yisrael has been what's helped us. So I think that's what you've seen. But as far as reading people's personal messages, which were written from their heart and with love and with all the right intentions, it's very painful. I think probably you ask anyone who's been bereaved to read these notes from people pouring out their hearts. It's beautiful, but it's very painful when you read it, and it brings you to tears. So we just didn't feel we had the koach to deal with that until now.
I mentioned the initiatives and the different things we read about, the incredibly beautiful things that have been done to commemorate their lives of your loved ones. Did it take time for you and your family to decide what would be most appropriate for each one of your of those you lost to be commemorated properly by whatever project, action, activity, or physical structure that you decided to dedicate?
To be honest, it goes back to the previous question, which is that had we had to decide, we'd still be thinking about it now. We might just about be getting around to the idea of what it should be, because the conversation itself is a very painful conversation when you try and sum up your loved one in one idea. But what happened was that, again, Am Yisrael stepped in And people came to us literally from the minute the shiva started. They were coming to us saying, can we do this? Can we do that? And all they needed was for me to nod my head, and they were rushing off to doing it. I mean, absolutely incredible. There's a park here in a frat. The youth of a frat, a bunch of 17-year-old boys came up to me in the shiva and said, look, we'd like to start a viewpoint for Maya, or for the girls, actually, in a frat. We'll find the location. We'll organize it with the local council. We'll raise the funds. All we need is for you to agree to do it in them, that we can do it in their name. I said, well, why not? 9 months later, one of them came up to me. Well, literally, one of them came up to me and said, look, I'd like to show you where we've done it. And I knew where it was because there's been a sign, you know, there they put up. But I was too scared to go because I thought it would be too emotional for me to go to see it. And it really was, because he showed me that these boys had built, the 20 of them, had built a pergola, chairs, benches, picnic tables. They planted trees and flowers and put in a watering system. They got the council to drill through the mountain to put the path in. They put in beautiful signs, like a metal sign and a photograph. And I was brought to tears because, you know, when we came to a frat, we came back to a frat 10 years ago. Lucy, a few years before we went to Chut for 6 years in England, having been in Israel at that point for 4 years beforehand. Lucy woke up one morning, we'd been back in England for a couple of years, and she said, we've got to go back to a frat. We've got to bring up the kids in a frat. We need a house in a frat. So I sold a house in England at that point and bought something in a frat 4 years before we actually went back. But her reasoning was the only place you could bring up Jewish kids, really, you know, the best level is in Israel. And she'd seen the 4 years we'd spent in a frat, the quality of the youth and the engagement and the get up and go. And she said, that's what we have to have. I mean, that's what we need in our kids. And the only place we can do it is in Israel. So when these boys came along and did this project, it was so much, you know, it was exactly what Lucy had brought us as a family to Israel for, was exactly that, their get up and go. So it really brought me to tears.
And by extension, by the way, I mean, your tribute to the youth of your community is amazing. And this audience knows my feelings about Efrat, being a Talmud, a student of Rabbi Riskin. I have followed Efrat since before it was Efrat and have visited many times and always dreamed about living there, frankly. But just, you know, not that the community needs another plug, but it does seem that you have been surrounded by an incredible support system. And I know people in difficult situations like this need a support system and often get it from relatives. And in your case, you got it from people around the world. But the immediacy of your community there in Efrat, Israel, the people around you directly, they seem to have taken the effort to comfort you and to be there for you to the nth degree. And it must be an amazing feeling, having made that decision to live there, and now everything you ever sought or needed from a community is now there for you.
It's very strange that just before we left in 2008 to go on Shlichut, there was the Merkaz Arav attack, and right. Sadly, a boy from Efrat, Abraham Moses, was killed. I think it was about 16 at the time, and Lucy was friendly with his mother and went to the shiva, and I was actually interviewing, believe it or not, for a shul in America at the time, so I was away the whole week. And this had a huge impact on Lucy. I mean, I didn't really understand what she was talking about when she talked about how people came together and whatever. I think it was a major decision factor for her in terms of coming back to Israel, that she saw how the community held together in a way that she'd never experienced anything like it in her life. And little did we know that, you know, I would be, and the kids would be the beneficiaries of that a few years later.
Unbelievable.
But unbelievable. I mean, really, you know, when this happened, it was obviously during Pesach, and by the time we buried the girls and Lucy, it was already 3 or 4 days into Pesach. We'd spent most of the time in the hospital, right, with Lucy, and then we came home. We were in such a daze. We couldn't even think of it, and we had family with us, whatever. The community literally came in, did all the cooking for us. I remember the first Shabbatot, they had a rota, which we had nothing to do with at all. And they would come, and the girls would be waitresses, and people would have cooked stuff for us, and they would bring the food and serve it and clear it, and, you know, And it was just, we were literally like in a 5-star hotel. We had everything because people were sweeping the floor. And then the shiver came, and you know, a kind gentleman in the shul gave us a tent, which he has, and put it, and got a team of people to put it up and take it down. They provided us with all the furniture. We had a lot of people coming, so they had wardens appointed who would be on like sort of, you know, 24/7 guiding people in and out. I mean, I just, you know, there were so many people involved. Literally, it must have been hundreds of people who were involved, and I haven't really had the opportunity to thank them, and I can't even name them because I look, strangely enough, a lot of the people who were most involved were not necessarily our closest friends, although a lot of our close friends were very helpful. But some of the people who just jumped in to help were people that, you know, we were more acquaintances, you know, and it was just absolutely incredible how people just, you know, they didn't ask, they just got on with it. That's, I think it's an amazing, amazing lesson in Chesed that, you know, you should never say, is there anything I can do for you? You know, that's already, you've already failed once you said that. You should just do it.
100%. It's one of the messages we've been transmitting, especially this time of year before Pesach, to our audience. Rabbi Leo D is with us live from Israel. The worldwide reaction, from your perspective, I mean, look, the timing, and remember, everybody, this is pre-war, the timing, the enormity, the fact that so many can relate to, you know, God forbid, if they would lose multiple family members in an ambush like this, you know, in one episode. I mean, but nonetheless, from your perspective, so it wasn't that surprising. There are episodes like this that we can cite that have, you know, gotten worldwide reaction. And unfortunately, there are too many of them, frankly. But this has happened before. But from your point of view, what was your reaction to the world reaction? Were you somewhat taken aback by the way that everybody wanted to be part of the effort to comfort you and your family during that time?
I don't know. I sort of switched inside me when it happened, and I just felt that, you know, I've always been very sensitive to the moral equivalence that is shown in the media. You know, for literally 20 years, it's been a passion. In fact, I was just reading a book at the time about American anti-Israel.
I apologize. Your phone is breaking up. Maybe just move a drop to a different location. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, is that better? I was actually taking up to a holiday in Tiberias. I was taking a book which I was reading, which is Can the Whole World Be Wrong? Which is a book about the American bias against Israel in the media over the last 20 years. So it's something which I was passionate about. I was going to give it to my son to read on holiday and my nephew to read on holiday. And then this happened. So first and foremost in my mind was the world has to know that Jews and Israelis are good and that the terrorists are bad. And it wasn't obvious to me that they would be able to make that distinction. And so my immediate reaction was to come out with that message and make people aware. And strangely, because I think what made this a worldwide story was because it wasn't, you know, there were three features that made it a worldwide story. Number one, the victims were not just Israeli, they were also British. Number two, they were women and not men. And number three, there were three of them and not one. Right. Or two. And yeah. I think that those were three factors that made it a worldwide story. And it was very important to me. I mean, that's strange. You know, you might sound very sort of contrived, but for some reason, I guess because I'd been reading this book literally just the day before, it struck me this is the opportunity to explain to the world that we are good and they are evil.
Yeah. And I think there may have been an additional factor, frankly. Everybody around the world can relate to a family Holomoid road trip, and you know, and what's the greatest fear that something, God forbid, go wrong on one of those journeys? Right. And so I think.
I mean, I think the innocence of the victims here, you know, it also was unique. You know, sometimes they can, the media can make out that, you know, they were guilty, whatever. I mean, if Christine Amanpour, Yimach Shamah, claimed it was a shootout. So, you know, CNN, of course, on their evil journey, decided to make it out as if these three innocent women were not innocent. And, you know, that is the level of evilness that only you get from the extreme press like CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera, you know, and maybe some sort of Nazi media outlets. Generally speaking, decent people don't do things like that. But most people understood that you know, these were innocent women who had no no malice, and yet they were evilly massacred by people who really, you know, were pure evil.
You've done a remarkable job, in my opinion, taking on the media, including some of the examples you just gave us, and being very, very strong publicly when it comes to the way that the media portrays your family or others in Israel, etc. At the same time, not that the two have to be mutually exclusive, I'm not suggesting that, but at the same time, in your public statements, you have gone out of your way, I think that would be an appropriate way of putting it, you'll let me know if I'm right, to discuss the eventuality of Jews living in peace in Israel and the importance of actually trying to live in a civilized way with our neighbors and our cousins in the Holy Land. And whether it be conflict with them or, God forbid, conflict within the Jewish people, within the Israeli people, that has to be avoided and worked on at all costs. Am I representing that properly?
Right. It's interesting. When this happened, I said, I love the Palestinians and I hate the terrorists.
Right.
And people said to me that was quite an unusual perspective, because usually people would just say, I hate all Arabs. Or they could, you know, a very small percentage of people are seen hugging the mother of the terrorist, you know, a week later. I think that for sure there'll be what I call shalom. And here I just differentiate between shalom and peace. Peace comes from the Latin pax, which means absence of fighting, and shalom comes from the Hebrew shlemut, which means completeness.
Yes.
So the way I liken it is, imagine two kids are fighting in a classroom, and you know, a teacher takes one, a teacher takes the other, and pulls them apart. Then you have peace. But until a third person comes along and says, "What were you fighting about? Let's sort this out," you don't have shalom.
Right.
So I think we're in a war at the moment for shalom, and there's an absence of peace because there's fighting. But the war is for shalom, and the result will be shalom, which is we will get to a suitable solution once we've eliminated the terrorists, and that probably includes Hamas, Hezbollah, and maybe a lot of the Iranian leadership, and maybe also we have to get rid of our reliance on America, and that's something which we you know, are witnessing in real time. So once we do all that, we can have shalom. And my proof for that, actually, is I was sent by the Foreign Office to Vienna immediately after the war broke out, to speak to some politicians there. And what I noticed was the Jewish community there is vibrant, growing, happy, well-supported by the state, loved by the government. The Viennese government, the Austrian government, was the first to ban Free Palestine marches. And yet, as we know, 80 years ago, a third of Viennese Jews were massacred by Austrian Nazis. Right. So 80 years later, the place of, you know, center of Nazism has turned into a wonderful, you know, paradise for Jews. And I think that it's not beyond the realms of possibility that, you know, we could be on good terms with our neighbors, you know, hopefully before 80 years' time, but, you know, maybe within a generation.
Wow, very nice.
That's the evidence. That's what's happened.
Yeah, well understood. Rabbi Leo D is with us. By the way, you've written an article recently about the relationship between the Haredi community and other communities in Israel, where you cite a lot of interesting points and have a perspective I've never seen before, frankly. I'm going to save that, if you don't mind. We're trying to put together a face-to-face encounter next month, please God, where we'll be able to have you on in a full-length interview. I'm going to save that conversation for then. I hope that's okay with you. Finally, I'm sure everyone is thinking, has anything in your mind changed since October the 7th? Obviously, your family among the primary victims of terror. That's an understatement. And then you witnessed and saw with the rest of the Jewish world what the enemy proudly displayed with their barbaric, torturous, terrorizing behavior of the 7th of October. And they're still holding our hostages in captivity on this day number 187. Has Rabbi Leo D. changed anything about his perspective because of that event, or essentially in terms of the bigger picture, things your position essentially remains the same?
Yeah, no, I think my position remains the same. And I think that the only difference is that hopefully there are other people now, you know, sadly, because of all the tragedy, there may be more people now who can see that we need a solution. One of the things that I started doing after the 7th of April, after our tragedy, was campaigning to stop the paper sleigh in the Palestinian Authority, campaigning to stop them training their kids to be terrorists, and so forth. And what I found, obviously, after the 7th of October, is that now there's, you know, probably another million people on the same campaign, and UNRWA has been, you know, singled out as this place of evil, which it is. And people are much more aware. I think we live in a time of gula, of revealed light. You know, it's terrible. I mean, to see people marching down the street with Palestinian flags on one hand, on the other hand, it is a bracha that these people who previously hated us and were hidden are now hating us and are very revealed. So I think we should be thankful for that. If I may just add one request for people at the Seder. I'd like to make the following request. And I think that we are in a time of revealed light now. We're sort of certainly a period of Geula. And people ask me, you know, is there anything we should do specially at the Seder night this year? And I think that there is one thing that one could do, which is to, with the people around the table who are all your loved ones, presumably friends and family, spend 10-15 minutes discussing if hypothetically we were to make Aliyah in the next year or two, where would we go? How many units would we want to buy? How would we accommodate the older people, the younger people, the kids at school, the high school, the college? What would it look like? And just have that discussion, even though you're not committing to anything, and you probably can't even commit to anything because it's Chag, but just hypothetically, what might it look like? Because I think that is really the focus of the Seder. It's really about, you know, how do we get back to Israel? The term Yetziat Mitzrayim was always a code word for Binyan Beit Shlishi, for coming back to Israel and rebuilding the temple. So, you know, if you want to do something this year, which I think really is meaningful, have that conversation. I think engage everybody around the table. You know, where would we go, and how would it look? Because I think that that is, you know, the most apt thing that one could do this year on Seder.
It sounds like Rabbi D endorses my request of the rabbinic leaders of the United States and the world that instead of discussing on Shabbat HaGadol how much Mara we're supposed to eat at the Seder, it might be a better idea to spend that lecture talking about the national mission of the holiday of Pesach. I think you could appreciate
that. I think you could do both.
Very good.
We'll have the conversation about this. We know how big a matzah is, and we know how big a cup of wine is.
Very good. I like that. I was going to ask you, I mean, obviously, the tragedy that we're referring to happened after last year's Seder. I was going to ask you, what will it be like for you a week from Monday night, sitting down to Leil HaSeder?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, like this week, actually all our memorial services have been this week. We had Friday, and then we had Sunday, and then we actually had Monday. And, you know, so we've had a load of, and I've got one this afternoon, I've got something on Friday, and we've got something on Motzash. Right? It's, you know, again, it's a process. It's very difficult each time, but it's beautiful because people are coming and want to be part of it, and it's lovely. But it's painful to have to, and yes, you know, it's, well, I'll tell you what, that everything that I've done this year has been painful the first time. Driving up the 90 road up to Tiberia when I did with the kids over Sukkot, the first time it's very painful because you're going over this again, but the second time I can tell you it's a little bit easier.
Right.
And I think that that's my experience, and everything we've done is, you know, it's been difficult because we're going back to restaurants I used to go with my wife, or we're going on holidays, places we've been with the kids, or we're going You know, so every first time is tough, but every second time is a little less tough. And getting on with it, because otherwise we couldn't do anything, because there's so many things that we have associations with in this country that, we'd just be locked inside if we didn't get on with it.
Wow. I look forward to seeing you when I get to Israel. I hope we can make that happen. And I wish you a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, as difficult as some might believe that will be for you and your family, but it should be a Chag that certainly continues to bring people together in the way that you just described. And Bezrat Hashem, we will look back on this Chag of being truly a Chag HaGeula. And thank you so much for joining us today, and our best to everybody. And again, I thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you in Israel.
Okay. Bezrat Hashem, Rabbi Leo D. on a Wednesday morning broadcast, and you're listening to JM in the AM.